Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 1st, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing the fallout from the Supreme Court's decision in the Horn Raisin Growers case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And we're very pleased to welcome to our call today two experts. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 8 to 10 minutes, then probably a little bit of back and forth between the two panelists. And then, as always, we'll be turning to you, the audience, for your questions. So please be thinking of those along the way. We're going to hear first momentarily from the Honorable Michael W. McConnell. He's a professor of law, and he's the director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center at Stanford Law School. He's going to be followed by Professor John D. Echevarria of the Vermont Law School. We're very pleased to welcome you both, gentlemen. With that, Professor McConnell, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean. I suppose my real qualification for being on the call is that I had the honor of representing Marvin and Laura Horn in Horn versus Department of Agriculture, the case we're going to be talking about this afternoon. This case went to the United States Supreme Court two times, the first time on jurisdiction, the second time on the merits. And the Horns prevailed both times unanimously on the jurisdictional point, 8-1 on the merits with a 5-4 split on the question of remedy, a question which had not actually been litigated below or even very much in the briefs. So let me give a little background about this case. It's a takings case under the Fifth Amendment, which provides that private property may not be taken for a public use without just compensation. It involves raisins. Raisins are regulated under a federal program that goes back to 1949 and the basic framework of the program for a variety of agricultural commodities back to the New Deal. Under this program, there's effectively a government-established and enforced cartel. There is a committee called the Raisin Administrative Committee, which is elected by members of the industry according to their size of their production. And so the committee is essentially controlled by the largest producers in the industry, and in particular SunMade, which has almost a majority of seats and therefore effective control. This committee decides how many raisins all the producers are able to sell. So you have to understand this is something which would be a per se violation of the antitrust laws if it were a purely private conspiracy, but instead it is a government-mandated, I won't call it conspiracy, government-mandated program. Each year the committee decides a certain percentage of the crop that can be sold, and a certain percentage of the crop, which is called the reserve, the raisin reserve, which cannot be sold. Instead of being sold on the market, farmers have to turn over these reserve raisins to the Raisin Administrative Committee, which again is technically an arm of the federal government, although it's effectively controlled by the dominant players in the industry. The Raisin Administrative Committee then does whatever it wants with the raisins. It gives some of them away to school lunch programs and that sort of thing, but the vast majority of them it sells and then uses the revenues for its own purposes, the largest one of those being to hand out subsidies to, surprise, surprise, the largest players in the industry, not coincidentally the same people who control the committee, for export subsidies. My clients are Marvin and Laura Horn, who are lifelong farmers of raisins in the Central Valley and California, independent growers. This is not a put-up case. This is a real person case where Marvin and Laura got increasingly frustrated with the program, which they believed not only offends their free market principles, but they believed actually hurts at least small raisin farmers, even if it does benefit the leading players. So they believed it hurts independent small raisin farmers, but it's very difficult to be able to challenge the program because the funny way in which it operates is that farmers, producers, sell to the middlemen, the packers, who are called under the statute handlers. The handlers then process and sell the raisins, and the statute technically regulates only the handlers. The handlers are required to set aside the reserve raisins and turn them over to the government. So note that the regulatory obligation runs to the handlers, although the economic incidence of having the raisins taken falls on the producers. Only the handlers have a direct regulatory relationship with the Department of Agriculture, and only they have a statutory right to sue if they are aggrieved by the program. Well, the Horns came up with a way to challenge the program. They effectively became handlers. They bought their own processing equipment, and not only their raisins, but the raisins of about 50 of their farmers were processed on their equipment, but they didn't comply with the program. Instead of sending the reserve raisins off to the Raisin Administrative Committee, they sold them and gave the full proceeds of the sales to the farmers who had produced them. Well, not surprisingly, and of course they knew this would happen, the government came after them and fined them the value of the reserve raisins plus some civil penalties. The reason this setup worked is that because they became defined as handlers, they were able to bring a statutory challenge, which they did, including a constitutional challenge under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment. This went up through the agriculture courts, through ALJs, and then to the district court, and then to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, all of which said, this is fine, it's not unconstitutional, until the petition for rehearing stage, at which point suddenly the government got scared and declared that actually all this whole time there was no jurisdiction to consider the Horns claim. This went up to the Supreme Court, and the court rejected it unanimously, sending it back. And at oral argument, the classic line was, I think it was Justice Breyer who said, well, what do we do next? And Justice Kagan said, well, we send it back to the Ninth Circuit to find out if this is a taking or just the most obsolete statute in the world. Well, it went back to the Ninth Circuit, to the same panel, and that court held that the program was not a taking, incidentally for different reasons than it had offered the first time. Again, the United States Supreme Court granted cert and considered three questions based upon the three rationales given by the Ninth Circuit. The first question is whether personal property, meaning property other than land, is covered by the categorical taking rules of the takings clause. I should drop a footnote here just to explain the vocabulary. That a taking when I just consider it an actual taking, an instance in which in which property is taken from the private party and actually becomes the property of the government, plus a few other cases where of the functional equivalent of that, are called categorical or physical takings, and the government simply has to pay for them. There is a second type of taking called a regulatory taking, which is usually a regulation of the use of the property. It's governed by one of those vague four-part tests, which is extremely government-friendly and virtually never results in compensation. So the Ninth Circuit held that a taking of personal property as opposed to land might be a regulatory taking, but it cannot be a real taking. They also held that it was not a taking because the Horns had voluntarily agreed to give up their raisins in exchange for the privilege of engaging in the raisin selling business in interstate commerce. And then finally, it wasn't a real taking because they retained a theoretical interest in the proceeds of the sales of their raisins by the Raisin Administrative Committee, if in fact any money was left over after all the export subsidies. One of the 2 years in question, the number was zero, and in the other case, a pittance. Supreme Court roundly rejected all three of those theories. There was one dissent on the second of those theories, or I'm sorry, on the third of those theories, that the right to a contingent interest and whatever might have been left over made it not a taking. That was Justice Sotomayor. But otherwise, it was a unanimous decision, except for the question of remedy, which had not even been bruited before. And on that, the court held 5-4 that the proper remedy was simply to reverse, while four of the justices said the proper remedy was to remand, I assume to the Department of Agriculture, but maybe to the district court, to see whether the overall benefits of the program should be deducted from the amount of compensation and result in a different figure. So in my opinion, this case is important primarily because of how it cuts through a number of abstract obstacles to recovery that have been put up in the past. It's really quite remarkable, I think, that the government would purport to take 47% in 1 year, 30% in another year of a farmer's crops and not guarantee them any payment for that whatsoever, but just to sell them and use them for export subsidies. If the takings clause means anything, it would seem to mean that the government can't do that. And yet, even in so obvious a case, it took 13 years, took three trips to the Ninth Circuit, two trips to the United States Supreme Court for these small farmers to have their rights vindicated. But I think in the course of that, the Supreme Court made certain things clear for the future. I think it helped clear up some of the jurisdictional obstacles that are put up in order to protect the government from having to defend these cases. The clear holding that personal property is fully protected just as much as land is going to have importance in some other areas of the law. The idea that this was actually a voluntary exchange and in exchange for the privilege of being able to do their business is a particularly pernicious notion that would have allowed the government to effectively extort property from anyone engaging in interstate commerce. And so I think that I don't view any of these principles that the court vindicated as being new, but there has been so much obfuscation about the takings clause over the last 30 or 40 years that it was welcome that the Supreme Court cut through some of the underbrush. Might note that the last, I believe it's five cases, maybe it's only four or five cases in the Supreme Court have all been reversals of lower court decisions that did not find takings. So I think and of those cases, all but one of them have been either unanimous or 8-1, which suggests that there's actually a very strong majority on the Supreme Court that's contrary to a certain current in the lower courts and more favorable to property claims.
Thank you so much, Professor. With that, let's turn to Professor Echevarria.
Great. Well, thank you, Dean, for the invitation, and it's a pleasure to be on this call with you, Professor McConnell. Let me start off with a couple of positive things, because I have a lot of negative things to say, but I want to just make sure people know that I can view even a case like this through a through a positive lens. So let me start off by saying that Horn offers, to me, a somewhat surprising but nonetheless ringing endorsement of the venerable doctrine of sovereign public ownership of wildlife. One of the surprising developments in the case that really only came to the fore during oral argument was the fact that the court was confronted with the old chestnut of Leonard versus Earl. And without getting into the details of the case, it's essentially a carbon copy of the Horn case, except it involves oysters and not raisins. And the Supreme Court unanimously rejected the takings claim. And what the court did in Horn is it distinguished the Leonard case on the ground that the case involved wild animals, oysters, and said everybody knows that the government has essentially unlimited authority to regulate the taking of wildlife because wildlife is owned by the public. So one of the ironic consequences of this otherwise pro-property rights decision, which in my view is better viewed as a 5-4 decision than an 8-1 decision, but that's an aside. But one of the ironic consequences of this five-justice majority opinion is that it provides a powerful argument that's going to resonate both in the legal arena and in the political arena against claims that the Endangered Species Act and other similar wildlife regulations infringe on private property rights. The second silver lining for the government side in the case is the court's implicit endorsement of the broad reading of the public use requirement in the takings clause, effectively reaffirming the majority opinion in Kelo and undermining the efforts by various critics to argue against Kelo and for a narrower reading of the public use requirement. Under this program, the government, as Professor McConnell describes, transfers raisins from the custody of handlers to schools and others, and the court had no trouble concluding that this constitutes a taking for a public use. And if this is a public taking for a public use, well, that means the court takes a very broad view of that element of the takings clause. And the point was simply highlighted by Justice Thomas, who pointed out that this broad reading of the public use requirement was inconsistent with the viewpoint he had expressed in his solitary dissenting opinion in the Kelo case. So moving on, there are a couple of reasons, in my view, to be concerned about the court even taking this case on. There were fundamental defects with the case as were presented to the court that should have led to a swift dismissal of the case. The first and most important defect, which regrettably the court simply overlooked, in my view, is that the Horns in the Supreme Court had no property right. No property interest upon which to base a takings claim. And to understand why this is so, we have to go back to Horn 1, in which the question was whether or not the Horns were permitted to proceed with their action in the federal district court in California or whether they should have gone to the Court of Federal Claims. And the court said that to resolve this issue, one has to make a clear distinction between raisin handlers and raisin producers. And the court said these are raisin handlers. The Horns are litigating this case as raisin handlers and solely as raisin handlers. And because they're raisin handlers, they're allowed to litigate this issue in the federal district court. Well, given that fact, it should have been clear to the court that the Horns, qua handlers, had no property interest. Indeed, if you could review the history of this case right up until the Supreme Court level, the one point that the Horns were hammering home was, we in fact are not handlers at all. We're not subject to the handler regulation because we don't own any of these raisins. And under the regulations, even if they complied with the regulations, they wouldn't have owned the raisins because the producers own the raisins and they're handed over to the handlers and they automatically get transferred to the custody of the Raisin Administrative Committee. So the handlers are never really owners. They had standing to challenge the penalties being imposed on them as handlers, but they had no standing to raise any takings argument. And you know, this was pointed out to the court, but they really blew past it without thinking about it very much. The other fundamental defect in the case is the third issue presented in the case was not properly before the court. It relates to an issue that the Ninth Circuit addressed in its first opinion back in 2011 in response to a petition for rehearing. The Ninth Circuit abandoned that position, and then dismissed the case for lack of jurisdiction, and then when they were reversed in Horn 1, addressed the merits of the case again, and in resolving the case on the merits, basically said, we think this is personal property, that's different from real property, and if we have to address the merits of the claim, we look at it as a nolen-dolen claim. But the third issue presented in the petition for certiorari, which is whether or not someone who engages in interstate commerce has to expect that their property will be subject to government takings, was not a position that the Ninth Circuit had taken below when the case was presented in Horn 2, and the court really had no business in taking up an issue that the court below had not even embraced. So I think there's some sort of, when legal historians unpack this case, they realize that it's a sort of an oddball case and never should it end up in the Supreme Court because it was based on a bunch of faulty premises. Turning finally to the merits of the issues the court decided, one is that the court said embraced a new sweeping, apparently unqualified, per se rule for government interferences with possessory interests in personal property. And all I can say is that can't be right, and the court can't be serious. The Food and Drug Administration has a law that authorizes the FDA to seize adulterated drugs. California recently passed, and the governor signed a law that says when an individual is adjudicated as dangerous to himself or others, the government can take firearms away from that person. It's a longstanding practice in many communities around the country for humane officers to come onto people's property and to remove starving animals or otherwise mistreated animals from their owners. There is a longstanding tradition of the use of the forfeiture power to seize private property from owners. Justice Rehnquist, in an opinion of some years ago, said, well, that's certainly not a taking. The court simply adopted, perhaps for this case only, a sweeping per se rule without regard to all the other kinds of cases that are going to come up that can't, at least in my judgment, and I'd be interested if the professor disagrees with me, can't possibly be subject to a per se rule. So, you know, I think the court announced a rule, applied it in this case, but it really remains to be seen how serious the court is about this rule and whether or not it exists and how it applies. And the final thing I wanted to say is that the court, I think in a surprising way, rejected the government's argument that the question of whether or not the Horns were threatened with a taking of their private property without just compensation had to be evaluated by looking at the offsetting benefits of the program to the Horns. As I agree entirely with Professor McConnell's characterization of this program as a government-authorized cartel. The effect of it was to limit the supply of raisins in the market and to raise the market price of raisins to the benefit of all raisin producers, including the Horns. The Horns may not have liked this program, but they reap substantial financial benefit from the market control imposed by the program. And so the natural question was, well, in figuring out whether the Horns had suffered a taking without compensation, we have to offset the harm they claim as a result of the reserve requirement and take into account the benefit that accrues to the rest of their crop. And that's the way in which the just compensation question is evaluated in takings law generally, and it seems only logical, as Justice Breyer argued at length, to apply the same approach in the inverse condemnation context. And without authority and frankly without any reasoning, the court said no, that cardinal rule doesn't apply in this context. So I thought that was surprising and disappointing. So just to wrap up, I mean, I take a different view of this. I don't think this is an important case. I hope it's not an important case. I think it doesn't address issues of path-breaking significance. And for the reasons I've suggested, I think there are all sorts of defects in the way in which this case was presented to the court and the implausible way in which it resolved a number of issues. that suggests to me that this will not turn out to be a landmark takings jurisprudence. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to revert to Professor McConnell, but before we do that, Professor, if you bear with me while I open the floor to questions so people can begin to queue up, in a moment we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Professor McConnell, I want to give you a couple minutes to respond to Professor Echevarria. In particular, I'm interested in what you have to say about the per se arguments. And I'm curious as to the distinction between real and personal property and whether they were treated differently under takings law, how that arose given the language of the takings clause.
Okay, well, how about if I just run through Professor Echevarria's various points and
of course,
some of them quickly and so he thinks that this will have a beneficial effect on the Kelo issue, whether property is taken for a public use. I'm glad he likes something about the case, but I'm afraid this is a forlorn hope in this case because nobody questioned that. It wasn't an issue. We didn't say a word about it. Kelo wasn't cited. It is true that Justice Thomas saw that it might have been an issue, but it wasn't, so I don't think that's going to have any effect. Case should have been dismissed. I think this is actually kind of a misunderstanding here. The procedural context here is a little bit complicated, but the Horns certainly did have a property interest. The whole basis for this case was the ALJ's conclusion that the Horns actually took possession of the raisins. They paid for them. The farmers were paid off essentially by becoming handlers and paying the farmers for all of their raisins, including the reserve raisins. The Horns took on themselves the full risk of this outcome in this case. They own the raisins. Every dollar came out of their pocket. I don't think the court blew past this without thinking about it. The government had argued this strenuously in Horn 1, and it became clear, I think, by the end of the oral argument in Horn 1, that it was just a misstatement of the facts of the case. As to the personal property issue, it certainly was raised by the court below. It was not raised the first time around. The idea of personal property being different had not come up prior to Horn 1. It came up on remand from Horn 1. Government didn't even argue it. This is something that the Ninth Circuit panel came up with itself. And what the panel said is it isn't that personal property isn't covered by the takings clause at all, but that it isn't covered by the categorical rule. It's only covered as a matter of regulatory takings and thus subject to the nebulous four-part test, which since the nebulous four-part test is really no protection at all. We, for example, didn't even bother to argue in the alternative that we would win under it because it's such a worthless doctrine. Effectively, what the Ninth Circuit had held is that personal property is barely protected at all. And that was one of the three questions presented. Government did not attempt to claim it wasn't presented, although they didn't really defend it on the merits. So it was certainly before the court. The most important – I want to say I kind of agree with Professor Echevarria that the court's statement that any possessory taking of any possessory interest automatically – results in compensation. If they said that, and I'd have to go back and see how unqualified the court put it. If that is what they said, that would of course not be true because there are well-established cases where the government has the right to take a property, for example, forfeitures and adulterated drugs and so forth. I take it that's the sort of statement that you might make when you say, well, in this country, we have a right of freedom of speech. Well, of course we have a right of freedom of speech, but there are also certain exceptions to it. This case wasn't about any of those exceptions. The government didn't cite any one of those exceptions, and I just assume that the exceptions are just as strong as they ever were. They weren't at issue in the case, and they are not called into question, I think, by the case. People don't read language in the Supreme Court as being absolute. They read it as having to do with the body of law that's at issue. In the end, I think the best point here is the question of offsetting benefits, the point that Justice Breyer raises in his partial dissenting opinion. But I do think that the majority was right to raise that, but I also want to get to the merits of it, too. The majority was right that that wasn't a proper remedy in this case, because this was not an inverse condemnation case. This was a case brought under the review provisions of the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act. And that act provides that the handlers may challenge any order of the Department of Agriculture that is legally questionable. The order here was the order either to turn over the raisins or to pay their monetary equivalent. There's no authority under the AMAA to order any other kind of proceeding. It's purely, in fact, the statute describes this, the challenge procedures, as being purely equitable in nature. This is an up or down proposition. The idea that because there are some vague general regulatory benefits from the other raisins having a higher price is simply not something that the AMAA has anything to do with it. There was nothing in the record about it. For this particular proceeding, it was a legal irrelevancy. I do agree that if this were some kind of an inverse condemnation action, that the question of offsetting benefits would come to the fore. I do suspect that these are not specific enough benefits to be offsets, but that's a very difficult an intricate part of the law. Every state has a slightly different law. The federal law is slightly different. So it's a bit difficult to say. I also think that the actual facts would show that the offsetting benefit is zero. The only empirical study of the raisin marketing program, and by the way, a study that was cited by the government in its brief for another proposition, the only empirical study is that over the long term, there is no net increase in profitability as a result of this program. There are a number of economic reasons why that's probable. Not every cartel is a successful cartel, and this particular cartel benefited the large producers who get the export support subsidies and probably did not benefit. I think it can be shown that it did not benefit farmers like the Horn. So I think that even if we went to the expense of having an entirely new proceeding with new record on facts that had nothing to do with the facts in the record of this case, my guess is that it would have been the offsetting benefits would have been zero.
Once again,
Dean, can I just interject? Can I just interject on a couple of points?
Yeah, just a second. Let me just make another call for questions. We don't have any questions pending at this point. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Now, Professor Echevarria, please go right ahead.
Hi, thank you, Dean. On the last point, this whole case and the validity of the penalties that were imposed on the Horns rested on the proposition that their theory was that we should not have been penalized because if we'd been forced to comply with the program, it would have been a violation of the takings clause, that is, the taking of our private property without just compensation. So it seemed to me the merits of their case ultimately depended on whether or not they were denied compensation to which they were due. And for that purpose, the offsetting benefits were entirely relevant. And you know, whether or not they would have succeeded on that issue, the government was entitled to make that case. And as I say, I don't think there's any basis for saying that a different rule should apply in an inverse condemnation case and a condemnation case. I'm delighted to hear you say that you think there must be some exceptions to this per se rule. But what's so troubling about this case is the court allowed for no exceptions. It issued an entirely sweeping per se rule. Even in the Lucas case, which some people regard as an extreme example of an application of a per se rule, the court went out of its way to identify exceptions to its per se rule. One of those, by the way, was, of course, none of this applies to personal property. And the court went on to say beyond that it doesn't apply to nuisances, it doesn't apply to background principles of property law. One hopes there are exceptions, but I've been racking my brain to figure out how, in the context of this kind of per se rule, one can explain and justify the exceptions that must exist. I take exception to your claim that the Penn Central analysis is a worthless legal claim. I mean, I think your client's claim was worthless under Penn Central because they had a modest claim of economic impact. They had no case on interference with reasonable investment-backed expectations. They had no case on character, given that the whole purpose of this program is to benefit the raisin industry at the price, at the cost of the public. If the only worthwhile claim is one that automatically results in plaintiff's victory, well, you know, then we're in another universe. On the Kelo issue, I think what this illustrates.
John, you know a lot more about takings cases on the ground. How often do claimants win under Penn Central?
They win with some regularity and increasingly. You can look to a recent Texas Supreme Court decision involving water rights, and there are cases. There are some frequency in cases under Penn Central, but I think that's entirely consistent with what the framers' intent was when they put in place the takings clause. On the Kelo issue, I think it highlights.
See, I'm skeptical that regulatory takings are takings at all. And I view the Texas water rights case as actually being a per se taking in disguise.
On the Kelo point, I think this emphasizes the point that the property rights advocates can't have their cake and eat it too. If you want a narrow reading of the public use requirement in order to prevent the government from exercising the condemnation power, that means the scope of the inverse condemnation power is likewise going to be limited, and people are going to be limited in their ability to claim compensation and inverse condemnation actions. And here you have the court in supporting an expansive view of an inverse condemnation claim, implicitly, I grant you, implicitly, but Justice Thomas knew what was going on, embracing and implying a very broad view of public use. And the court simply can't sustain that broad view of public use and then entertain the opinions of critics that the public use requirement should be narrowed. And finally, I'm not going to belabor the point, but I really take issue with you what the record says about ownership. I mean, I think if you look at what the business model was that the Horns adopted or what the regulations were that they should have complied with, that the only owners of raisins at issue here were producers and then the Raisin Administrative Committee, and the handlers were at best they were baileys or they were custodians of property belonging to other people. And as I say, that was the Horns' theory up until they got into the Supreme Court, that we don't own any of these raisins, and they should have been held to that position and not allowed to reverse themselves on the property ownership issue in the Supreme Court.
Well,
questions.
In a sense, you're right that the Horns said, first of all, we are not handlers, and therefore the entire regulatory regime does not apply. We should win on that. And then they said, but if it does apply, that is, if we are handlers, then it's a taking of property. It was the government that then said, yes, you took possession of the raisins. That means you are handlers, and that's why it applies. And so it actually was the government's victory on this point that set up the constitutional claim.
Well, the government's position, which was accepted at every stage of proceedings, and wasn't addressed in the Supreme Court, was you are handlers because you acquired these raisins. That is, you physically took custody of them. And we don't dispute, the government said, that you don't own these. You claim you don't own them. That's fine. We know you don't own them, but that doesn't matter. You became subject to the handler regulations as soon as you gained physical custody, and that's all we needed, the government said, in order to exercise regulatory jurisdiction. So the Horns consistently took the position that they didn't own the raisins, and nobody disputed that claim. Nobody argued with that claim until relatively late in the proceedings, the Horns formulated a specific takings theory, which is that as handlers, they had been denied a property right. But after Horn won, when the Supreme Court said this case going forward is limited to takings claims that may be asserted by handlers, maybe the Supreme Court didn't know what it was doing, but I think what it did is it sounded the death knell for this takings claim, and Horn won because the Horns qua handlers had no place to go because they never owned any raisins. And maybe the Supreme Court was embarrassed to say.
The government tried to argue that. They ultimately realized it was false on the facts, gave it up, and not a single justice bought that argument. And I think the reason is when you look carefully at what happened here, unlike most cases, the reason the government had argued the contrary originally is that most handlers don't actually buy the reserve raisins. They don't pay for them. The Horns did pay for them. The producers got full price for all of their raisins, including the reserve raisins. So in that case, title passed from the producers to the handler, and the handler owned them. And the Horns were on the hook for every dollar.
That's not my understanding of the facts. That the Horns might have been middlemen for money passing hands, but they were simply taking money from customers, which they then transmitted to the owners, which were the farmers who were having their raisins processed by the Horns. But as qua handlers, the Horns never assumed ownership.
If that had been the theory, then the proper result would have been to order the fine against each one of the producers, each one of the 50 farmers.
Only handlers are subject to this rule, and the Horns were the handlers.
I don't know that it's very helpful to argue the facts here, since this is never going to come up again. If the Horns were merely middlemen, which is the way they had actually tried to set it up and argued before, they lost on this. They tried to present themselves as renting out the production equipment, the handling equipment, to each of the farmers. This was rejected. And when it was rejected, the implication of that is that the raisins actually went to them. They acquired them, which is what was said. The ALJ held that they took possession of them, and that's enough of an ownership interest to qualify under the takings clause.
Well, that's a different theory. Then the theory is that they were not the owners. They were owned by the growers, but they were bailees or custodians of somebody else's property, and were entitled to bring a takings claim on behalf of the true owners. I don't know what precedent.
Well, even bailees actually can bring the claims, but
I don't know of any authority for that.
Well, we cited authority in our brief.
Gentlemen, we do have a question from our audience. If I can interrupt this discussion and turn to our audience now for a question. And if you're in the audience and you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Professor McConnell, I'd like to ask you what you see the impact of the Horn case being in conjunction with government actions in times of financial crisis, such as the ordering by the government of the termination of 24% of the General Motors and Chrysler franchises and similar actions in the AIG case.
Well, I would have to know more about what actually happened. In terms of cancellation of the franchises, I don't believe that those franchise rights were transferred to the government, right?
No, they actually were, i.e. the government taking over General Motors, which then acquired all of the territorial rights of the dealerships that were confiscated and certain restrictive contract rights, et cetera.
Well, again, I don't know all the details of this, but if you're talking about the government taking over General Motors, they did that for compensation, right? I mean, the government put in money and got an ownership interest. Is that right?
It put in money to General Motors, but the requirement for any money to go to General Motors was the termination of thousands of auto dealerships. And those terminations then resulted in property going back directly to General Motors and the government.
Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about how this works, but it doesn't strike me as quite parallel to Horn in that so dealerships are terminated. When dealerships are terminated, some of the property of the franchisees or the dealers goes back to the company. Is that right?
In a manner, yes.
Because I would think for the most part what's happened is that their property becomes valueless, not that it gets transferred to the government. And that's a use restriction. It might be a use restriction subject to Lucas.
Okay.
I don't view Horn as holding that Lucas applies to personal property, although it might well. Lucas left that question open. But because Horn wasn't a Lucas case, I don't know that it applies to that situation.
Once again, if you have a question for either of our guests, our lines are now wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
I think the larger issue that all these government bailout or takeover cases are likely to go off on is the question of the sort of the but-for case. If General Motors had gone into bankruptcy and gone through reorganization or gone through a bit of liquidation, or AIG had gone through bankruptcy, well, then where would the shareholders have been of AIG, or where would the dealers of General Motors have been? And the government, as many people online will know, the government's primary line of defense is, well, you would have had nothing. And so, you know, whatever the government did, or however you characterize it, there wasn't really any harm, because at the end of the day, the claimant was left with the same as they would have had if the government hadn't intervened to try to reorganize or bail out the company. But that doesn't directly address the question, but I think it identifies the issue on which many of these cases will go off.
Though I don't know, it could be that there are some interests within General Motors or AIG that were made worse off.
I think that's the argument being made in the GSE cases, the Freddie and Fannie cases, where the government came in and gave 187 point something billion dollar bailout and took some of the shares in return. And have since been taking all the profits of both Freddie and Fannie. They were originally supposed to take 10% service on their bailout, but now they've been made whole. They've recovered every bit of their bailout plus interest, and the pre-existing shareholders are receiving nothing. They're making a takings claim, and I think the government, at least in part, is saying, had it not been for us, you'd have nothing, so you get nothing. We do have another question from our audience, so let's turn now to another member of the audience.
Well, I guess the question, and following up on this, the first question, and then I'd like to follow up with this, is a contract right a personal property right?
It is certainly not a real property interest. So if it's property at all, it would be personal. Now, in terms of the constitutional categories here, there's a real difficulty in that if you look at the original Constitution prior to incorporation, the states were prohibited from impairing the obligation of contract, but were not prohibited from taking property without just compensation, whereas the federal government was prohibited from taking property without just compensation, but not prohibited from impairing the obligation of contract, which meant that under that constitutional arrangement, you had to distinguish between impairments of contract and takings of property.
Right.
Since incorporation, that has ceased to be an important question, and especially when after Blaisdell, when the contracts clause is effectively eviscerated, but the now the property the takings clause has been extended, that difficulty has, I think, become, as a practical matter, unimportant.
Okay. If it's are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. If it's unimportant, then you would think that the franchise, the rights of the franchisees when they were terminated would have been a contract right that they had to continue at least to sell GM cars for the period of the franchise. Or in the case of the Fannie and Freddie termination of contract, those were preferred stock rights, which had dividends that were paid out over time that were just unilaterally terminated by the government. Or in the case of the AIG, you would have had a contractual right, which was your stock interest, which suddenly became worth 20.1% of what it was worth before the government decided to take 79.9% in violation, I might add, of the Delaware anti-takeover statute. So those contract rights not addressable in the federal?
Well, I don't think the reason they're not addressable is because they're personal property. I don't think that's going to be the problem.
Right, but when you bought
the, I'm thinking now of the sports team. They're sometimes city when they find out when a city finds out its sports team is going to flee. There have been cases where they exercise eminent domain against the franchise. And the franchise is nothing but a web of contracts, as I understand. We're not talking about the stadium or anything of the sort, but the web of contracts. And they have paid money under the Fifth Amendment for the value of those contractual rights. But those are cases where the government actually takes the interest in the property, just as they did in Horn. I'm not sure that that's what went on in the cases you're describing.
I think it happened in every one of them.
Where the government actually
took 79.9% of AIG for nothing, when the bankruptcy would have protected AIG and would have protected the AIG stockholders because AIG was solvent at the time of the takeover?
Well, if it's true that
the AIG board of directors said that 20% of something is better than 100% of nothing, and so they thought they were getting a good. The reason the board of directors of AIG approved the deal is they thought they were going to be wiped out of bankruptcy, and even if they were going to be diluted, the diluted share was going to be more valuable, and that's why they went with it.
Yeah, but that wasn't the case, and I don't think the board of directors had any case had that. And in a bankruptcy, the board of directors could have sought bankruptcy protection, but they weren't given that option by the government. They were just told they had to turn over the company. With respect to Fannie and Freddie and the stockholders, the preferred stockholders in that case, they had a preferred script. They had a preferred script that was paying out in a solvent company, and they bought it after the government takeover because they knew that their preferred stock was going to pay out because Fannie and Freddie, because they were preferred against over the common stockholders. And then the government just came in and unilaterally wiped out the preferred. By the way, I have no interest in any of these cases. I've just been following them. And with respect to the GM, those franchise rights were, they may not have been franchise rights in perpetuity as a sports franchise would be, but they were franchise rights for a period of time that were clearly contractual rights. So I think that overall we've got a pattern of government taking of property that is either being ignored because the courts don't understand it. I'm a corporate lawyer, and I don't think litigators very much understand these rights. Or we have, you know, just completely thrown the Constitution out the window because of some sort of understanding of property rights that I can't follow.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here because I don't know that much about the GM case and haven't thought about contracts in quite a while. But I assume in the GM bankruptcy, that in Chapter 11, the question is whether or not the debtor would repudiate or retain various contractual commitments, and they would have the authority to do that in bankruptcy. And that is part of a reorganization proceeding under the bankruptcy power, I believe consistent with the takings clause. GM could have wiped out some of its contractual commitments in order to become a going concern again. If that were true,
that would have been a bankruptcy proceeding, which would have been governed by a judge and would have looked over it, not a government just coming in and taking over without any regular order at all and just picking and choosing which franchisees were going to survive and which weren't, based on rationale that we still don't understand.
Well, I guess my point is that if that's what would have happened, if they had gone through the bankruptcy process, then the government's primary line of defense, and it seems to me not entirely implausible, is no harm, no foul, that the franchisees would have lost out in the bankruptcy process, and so whatever wrong may have been committed, it's a harm that did not cause them any economic injury, and therefore no violation of the takings clause.
I don't think you can say that in GM. I'm much more familiar with the Fannie and Freddie cases and the AIG case than I am with that case. But
this is what the court ruled, as you know, in the AIG, the trial court ruled in the AIG case, is that the shareholders would have been wiped out, and therefore the fact that they were left with a highly diluted stock interest, which was less than they started with, doesn't support a takings claim because there's no showing of any economic harm.
Which I attribute only to the fact that the case must have been poorly argued because AIG was not insolvent and would not have been insolvent, and the shareholders would have gotten much more in a bankruptcy.
Most people think that David Boies made the most of that case that anyone possibly could have, but I didn't follow it that closely either.
Well, that's another story. But
it does seem to me that the answer to these questions depends upon rather specific factual information that at least I know I do not have under my belt.
Why don't we move then, this is Dean Reuter, in another direction. We've just got a couple minutes left. We have maybe gone a bit far afield here. I brought up the GSE cases, so that might be my fault.
But I think these may be the most important takings cases going, I think they require more specialized knowledge.
Right. Why don't we let me give each of you professors a chance to make a final statement here as we close. Let's start with Professor Echeverria. If you could just literally be 60 seconds or less, that would be great, Professor.
I guess the interesting question going forward, and the one that I think has real significance, is the scope of the purported per se rule for personal property. And I don't think there's any question that the court articulated a rule in sweeping terms. It identified no exceptions. The last time the court came up with a per se rule in Lucas, it went out of its way to identify exceptions. I guess the field is now open for creative minds to figure out exactly whether or not this per se rule can withstand scrutiny and how one can justify and explain all the exceptions that I think everyone on the phone recognizes have to exist.
Professor McConnell, final thought.
Well, I don't think the per se rule is new. I think the Ninth Circuit's holding was the first time any court had ever said that the per se rule doesn't apply to personal property, and since all these exceptions have existed, you know, way back into the common law, and against a per se rule, I just think that this is an imaginary problem. I think the more interesting point is how the relation between per se takings, actual takings, and regulatory takings is going to develop, and I think that Horan was a step toward clarification that it's in the realm of actual takings, not use restrictions, that the Fifth Amendment principles really apply.
Well, gentlemen, let me thank you both. I certainly appreciate your time and your expertise here today. To our audience, thank you as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 3 p.m. when we'll have a Courthouse Steps version of Teleforum. We'll be talking about overcriminalization in the case Clay versus U.S. It's a regulatory crimes case that's being argued tomorrow morning in the 11th Circuit. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. for our next Teleforum call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.